You are listening to the Lazy Equity Podcast, brought to you by Bobby Hayeri and Darren Venter, founders of the Investors Agency and DEBA. With over 20 years' experience in real estate between them and having bought hundreds, if not thousands, of properties around the country, you are in the right place to learn all things property. This podcast is designed to educate and empower everyday Aussies to take control of their future through property.
Hey guys, and welcome to the latest episode of the Lazy Equity Podcast. And on this very special International Women's Day podcast, we've got a very, very special guest, Maddie Walton. Now, we're super excited to have Maddie on the show. She's a superstar mortgage broker, achieving great things for her clients. Throughout this podcast, you guys are going to see some nuggets of gold and some alternate ways of thinking. If you do have equity in your property, or if you are looking to get into your first property, then this episode is going to be extremely valuable for you. I'm really excited to be joined by Christy Nielsen, my co-host as well, special International Women's Day episode. I'm sure you guys are going to love this. If you want to follow Maddie, you can do so on Instagram at Money with Maddie. Let's get into it. Maddie, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you. And Christy, thank you so much as well. You're going to make my job easier, hopefully.
Yeah, I'm excited, and happy International Women's Day.
I know. I can't believe it's 2024 International Women's Day already. It's come around really quickly. I can only just remember last year as well. It's a beautiful time to celebrate women, and I love being here for it. So thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So you're down from the Gold Coast, and you were saying before the recording that you do come down quite often.
I do, yeah. So a lot of my family are in Sydney, and they're also in Melbourne too. So I travel quite a bit. I'm down every couple of months, which is great to see beautiful faces like yours and also my family, clients, and other referral partners. It's fantastic.
That's nice. And you were doing quite a few, not awards, but I guess events.
Yeah, there's always a lot of events, and I try and link them all up or align them when I'm in each state. I've got a packed schedule for the next 2 weeks. It should be great.
Nice, including Taylor Swift.
I know, I'm so excited. Nice.
So who's Maddie personally?
Maddie is a 26-year-old beach girl, I guess, from the Gold Coast, originally born in Manly. So I think that's where the beach started, as you guys probably would know. She's just someone that is very social, loves to educate, is very transparent on all areas of her life. And that's kind of where everything led for me in a career in property and finance. So yeah, that's just, I guess, a little bit about me. Not really much, but I think my whole life is work, and in the best way possible. I'm so passionate about what I do. And so I feel like that just takes over my personality quite a fair bit. You probably know the feeling.
Yeah, and you definitely seem passionate about what you do, which is why I wanted to reach out, and you're so relatable. Mm. And I think a lot of people will get a lot out of this podcast, but also like your social media. I feel like it's really helpful to people for a lot of property and finance talk to be broken down into easy to understand kind of terminology, and not using all that jargon that's just way over people's heads. So I think it's really nice to have someone who can be relatable and support people in an easy to understand journey.
No, I appreciate that. It's something I pride myself on, and something that I realize I am quite good at is making complex topics easy to understand. And that's where social media comes into play. Things are always bite-sized and digestible. So it was a really nice transition to be able to do that and move into the property space there. Yeah.
Going through your social media, you've got like 2 million views on some of your videos.
It's crazy.
And going through the comments, very inspirational. And like Christy said, you break everything down very simply for your followers. So it is very refreshing, because in the mortgage broking space, it is not very often that you see people that can break things down like that. But also we're going to talk about this as well in terms of your personal experience. Seeing a young female in the mortgage broking space as well is very refreshing in the finance space.
No, I appreciate that. I think it is something that in the property and finance world, as you would know, it's very male dominated. And sometimes that can be quite intimidating for a lot of people that are young wanting to enter the market. Yeah. So having someone who's familiar and relatable, it can be a big superpower for me. And that's why I make sure I'm so transparent and guiding people on how to get there, because the process is very confusing when it's your first time buying a property to live in or an investment. It is quite overwhelming. So having people on your side that can explain the process from end to end nice and simply, and just guide you through and make it not feel overwhelming, is such a big thing, I think.
Yeah, and that sort of ties me into the first thing I was going to mention. We were doing some digging around the other day, and you did 50 inspections for your first property.
Yes.
And how many? Let's talk about that experience there and what you learned there.
Yeah, so I wasn't always in property and finance. So my first career was in science. So I was in medical science. I was a vaccine developer. So that's what I did in uni. That's what I did outside of uni. And I bought my first home in August 2021. So about 2.5 years ago now, which is crazy how fast that's gone. Time flies really quick when you're having fun. But yeah, prior to that, I was working two jobs to get to my deposit, to what I needed to buy my property. So I was working in the lab full time and I was working in retail part time. So I was working 7 days a week. And then
how many, like when 20,
60, 70 hours. Yeah. So I was full time in the lab, 14 hours a day usually. And then I was, yeah, about 25, 30 hours a week in retail on late nights and weekends. Wow. So it was pretty intense.
What do you think, I don't know, I want to let you continue on with that answer. So apologies. So what do you think drove you to have that motivation to work that hard at that age?
Yeah. I mean, I've always wanted to buy property. It's been a goal of mine since I was 15. I've been saving since I was 15 to buy my first house. Wish I could have bought pre-COVID. I was trying, my brain was there, but I wasn't in a full-time job. I had set aside saving my deposit, but when you don't have the income to support, you can't get anything. Yeah. So that's when I, you know, got out of uni. I was like, get my first full-time job and really go guns blazing.
Yeah.
For me, it's more of a personal thing. I wanted stability. I've jumped around a lot and rented a lot, and I don't like being kicked out of my place or the rent going up on me, that kind of thing. So it was really important for me to have that stability in a home.
Sure.
That's why I bought my first property as a house to live in, and it was a big property, 3-bed, 2-bath, 2-car on an 800 square meter block.
Yeah.
Great investment for me. It's done well. But again, it was something I could grow into. If it was something I was like, I don't want to buy property again, I can stay here. That was the, I guess, the thought process when I was buying.
700K back in 2021. Is a substantial amount for your first.
It was huge.
For your first property.
It was massive.
Big
it was above any of the first home concessions and grants and everything. So I was going to start small with a unit. Yeah. And then when I had the borrowing capacity with the two jobs, I was like, nah, go big or go home.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was.
You're glad now.
I am glad, but that mortgage repayment, she's not fun at the moment with the rates. But I have two people living with me, renting off rooms, I'm subletting. So that obviously helps.
Yeah.
If I had my time again, would I have bought an investment as my first property? Probably. But I'm so grateful for where I am at and how I've gotten to where I am.
Yeah.
But yeah, buying a property when I was, at 20, I was 23. It was a big feat to do on my own as a solo woman. And it was something I wasn't really taken seriously for, which is what led into so many inspections, so many offers. And I was like, you know what? I just need to use a buyer's agent and get the deal done. So
what do you mean you weren't being taken seriously for? Elaborate on that a little bit.
People wouldn't talk to me. Real estate agents wouldn't look at me. They thought that I was just there like as a friend for some people. When I went with my dad, cause I was like, maybe I just need a man there. Cause I didn't have a partner. They would just talk to my dad. Wow. Even when I bought my property, I remember it so clearly. I bought my property and I was having my building and pest inspection because I actually bought my house sight unseen. I was working 7 days a week. And I had the building pest inspection. It was the first time I saw that house. And he just spoke to my dad the entire time. Sure, granted, I'm not going to understand a thing you say. I get that. Like, fine. But I still would like of him to be speaking directly to me. I'm like, I'm paying you, but you're speaking to my dad and explaining everything to my dad like I'm not here.
Yeah.
And I think it's just something that's really common, and I think a lot of single women would understand. I was, a lot of brokers were like, you can't buy unless you have a partner. Where's your husband? Where's your partner? Okay, go guarantor. You need parents that have guarantor. I didn't have parents that could go guarantor. They don't own property. So I wasn't in a position that a lot of people are fortunate to be in where they have family gifts and they have guarantors, which is great. If you have that, leverage it to the best of your ability. Yeah. I'm so happy when people have that opportunity.
Yeah.
I just wasn't in that boat. So that's why I decided to go through a buyer's agency. I wasn't being taken seriously. I was going to so many inspections. I was making offers. I went to 8 different mortgage brokers by the time I ended up giving up and just using the mortgage broker that my buyer's agents recommended just to get the deal done.
8 different mortgage brokers. That's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. Again, need a guarantor, need a partner. You can't do this with two jobs. They'll only take you your main job. And I was in both jobs for a year and a half, which as a broker now, I know that's easily explainable.
Yeah.
Unless you're working 100 hours a week, it's not realistic. Then they won't take it. But if you're working two jobs and you've been working them consistently for over 12 months, there's no reason that a bank won't take both jobs and both incomes. So many things. I had pre-approval originally with a broker for $500,000. They said I couldn't take that second job. And then I was like, okay, fine. And then I decided to talk around with more people, post on Facebook groups, on my social media, on my Instagram page, people like, nah, get a second opinion. So that's where I was like, okay, I need to go to more people. They just were not, I don't know. I had high expectations because I was documenting everything through my social media page.
Yeah.
And so that was really important to me, to have someone who was clear, who was transparent, who would explain everything to me, who was the person that I could go to for expertise.
Yeah.
But so many of them are like, well, what do you want to borrow? What do you want to do? What kind of bank do you want to go with? And I'm like, I don't know. That's why I'm coming to you. I can tell you I want to borrow $2 million. That's not going to give you anything, is it? So that was
what really ended up happening in the end. Like, what did the broker do differently that the other 8 brokers couldn't do? Like, he went to a different bank, or
I went with Bank West, which was fine. They took both my incomes. That was great. He did a fine job. He was fine. He got me the property in the end. It was, when I think of the process and the experience, it wasn't smooth. However, he still got the job done.
Yeah.
But as soon as settlement day came, I have not heard a thing from him. And that was 2.5 years ago. I have not heard a single thing from that broker in 2.5 years. As soon as it was settlement, congratulations, that was it.
You'd think in an industry like mortgage broking, when you get clawbacks and their retention is just as important as a new client, that post-settlement nurturing,
it's just as important as
getting a client on board.
I had so many issues with the bank and getting all my direct debits set up. I had a lot of late fees because they weren't taking direct debits from the right accounts, all those kind of things that you try and talk to a broker about. I genuinely have not heard a thing to this day.
Yeah, and it's even more shocking because they actually really took the time to get to know you and your ambitions and where you'll end up. Like, you have that amazing property and now you've got all this equity, and the next property, I'm sure, will create equally more wealth and then where will you end up? Exactly. Yeah. If they're taking care of you from the beginning,
absolutely,
they would have got that business.
And your followers on social media and all the views you're getting, like, that's a big opportunity missed there, because they didn't take you seriously.
I mean, they didn't even ask the kind of questions. They didn't even know about my social media. Yeah. And I didn't really want anyone to. I wanted people to be, you know, I wanted to see how people really interacted with people.
Yeah.
Genuinely, I think sometimes if people can see a benefit from working with you, they may not treat you the same way as other people will.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make sure I was just an everyday person, and I still haven't heard a thing. And all those other brokers, they also didn't reach back out to me. So it just was something I was like, there's got to be better out here. And I love property. I love finance. It's a huge passion of mine, why I started my Instagram page. I just didn't believe that there was a job that I could do in the industry that would make me feel fulfilled. I also don't believe in it being expensive or inaccessible to access education and resources to help build your wealth and financial literacy, which is again why I started my Instagram page. I wanted to break down the stigma of surrounding money conversations, allow people to feel comfortable about discussing money, salary, wages, mortgages, but I also wanted to be free. And being a mortgage broker, my services are completely free, and I absolutely love that. So I do absolutely believe in paid services like financial planners, buyers agents, all those things, but I really love that I get to do something completely for free for somebody.
There's no reason for them not to come to you rather than going direct to bank, for instance, and just having that person who can get them the right product for what they're looking for, rather than them just going to one option. They can just go to various banks through one person, and just all hard work's done for them. It's a no-brainer, especially because it is free. So
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you have to do all the work yourself. Even if you go to a bank, you've got to fill out all those application forms, do everything yourself, whereas I just handle it all for you.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work behind the scenes, I think a lot of people don't realise, but it's so empowering. And to allow, like, I've gotten so many photos today from some of my clients that have just moved in this week to their homes.
That's
just fills my cup so much. It's amazing. Yeah. So being there for people, I'm going to be with them for 30 years. And as they, you know, grow a family, they upsize, they build their wealth through investment properties. It's so special to be taken on that journey with people. And I feel so grateful to be a part of it. So, yeah.
And your clientele, are they mostly Gen Y and millennials?
Yes.
Mostly females?
Gen Z millennials. No, not mostly females, actually. Yeah, so around the 20 to 40 years bracket, just because I feel like that's where a lot of first home buyers, first property buyers are. Yep. And I'm really, I guess, geared towards that, or building wealth through those first and second homes. I truly believe your first property purchase is going to set you up for the rest of purchases.
100%,
so yeah. Generally, I'm working with people. My first question on my calls, or one of my first questions, is what are your goals in 5, 10, 15 years time with property? Are you just wanting to buy one home and it's going to be a forever home? But or are you going to buy a property, this is your first one, and you're going to want to use it to build wealth for yourself in the future for other properties?
Yeah.
It's really important to not understand the first purchase and what someone wants in immediate term, but where they're going to be moving in 3 to 5 years time plus, because, you know, that first strategy is so important and it can make or break your next purchases, as you guys would know.
How often do we see, Christy, people purchase like their first property, or they come to us like, we purchased this property a few years ago and it's just completely suffocated future serviceability?
Yeah.
Have you thought about that strategy that you guys do? And we don't, not many brokers do ask those sorts of questions for like 3 years time, 5 years time.
Yeah, because I mean, like, you would know if someone buys a property and it's, you know, really negatively geared and it's their first one, what are they going to do to be able to use that income to purchase the next one? They can't, they're stuck.
Yeah.
And then they've got to pay capital gains, they've got to pay all that to sell it, to buy, actually redo it again. So
yeah,
it's important.
The strategy is so important, and just taking that time to think of your long-term goal and then work back from there. I think any goal you ever have, working with the end in sight is always so important.
Absolutely.
So,
light at the end of the tunnel, for sure.
100%.
Do you, this is coming from a personal experience with my wife, and I want to know if you sort of, if you see this at all with the experiences you've had with your clients. So my wife, when she went into uni, she studied quite hard and hustled a lot because she knew that she's got, you know, 5, 6 or X amount of years before she wanted to take time off for maternity leave.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite a hustle for that. She was hustling quite a bit for that 5 or 6 years, because there's a disadvantage to women that when they do have a child, potentially they might be off work for some for 3 months, some mm-hmm. for 6 months, some for 3 or 4 years. So there's a big pause on their career. Do you see many women thinking about this, or many younger women thinking about this, if they are planning to have children, in regards to trying to get into the property space before they have kids, because you know, that opportunity is there?
I think a lot of women in this day and age are so determined to do things on their own and to really build wealth themselves at the start. I think just in general, people realize that they need to do the work early to be able to benefit long term. And that's where that whole piece of, what are your family goals? Where are you wanting to be? Is this property going to be something you're living in for 5 years? And are you going to have a family here? So do you need an extra bedroom for when you're going to need to have, when you're going to have kids?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So yes and no. I think that in the Gen Z range, I think people are having children later in life anyway, but I do see that women are taking precautions and are planning further in advance, knowing what they need to do. But I also see women taking less time off work as well.
And out when of they choice have, or out of not lack of choice?
Out of choice. A lot of women that I speak to are like, I'm back in the workforce in 6 months, but they go part-time and they're just more flexible. Banks are fine with that. And even they'll give you a loan if you're on maternity leave. I actually did for a client, I've actually just got her a pre-approval. She's on maternity leave right now. She's just separated from her partner, so she's a single parent, going on the single parenting scheme, 2% deposit.
Wow.
And she's going to be buying for her young kid, and they're just using single parenting payments and the return to work. And all you need is a return to work letter stating when you expect to be returning to work.
Yeah.
And a bank just needs to see that you have what's called a shortfall or enough in savings to cover the repayments until you return to work.
Yeah.
Banks are quite understanding with it. My big thing is, how is your super going to be growing in the time that you're off work? How's your partner going to be supporting you if you have a partner while you're on maternity leave?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. What's your career looking like after you go on leave?
And do you talk to
them
about that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I do. I think it's important. So some people don't even, like, a lot of brokers just talk about mortgages, and that's not why I'm in this game. I want to, it's a holistic thing. Money is not just your mortgage, it's your budget, it's a lifestyle, everything. Like, money really ties into every area of life.
Yeah.
And so making sure people are prepared as best as they can for each of those financial decisions and lifestyle changes is so important to me. When people are buying property and they buy it, you know, they have strategy around buying it in one name on one title for, you know, capital gains or investment purposes, get a binding financial agreement, you know, have something written up, go to lawyers, be smart about it, because property is a long game. I don't believe, I mean, you can flip and sell properties, but I believe in holding investments for the long term.
Yeah.
And if you're going in with someone, you need to make sure you're covered as well, from a female and a male's perspective, no matter who is the person that's you're bringing in most of the money,
yep.
you want to support yourself moving forward. So yeah, it's a holistic approach, not just, all right, you want a loan? Here, I'll get it for you. So that's good. It.
Yeah. Wow. And do you find that there's a typical mistake that people make either with buying in, like, I don't know, single or relationship? Is there a common mistake that you find that maybe people in a relationship make when, or if people in a relationship that try to do it solo, like on their own, is there a common like mistake that you've seen that people make?
From like a personal finance perspective?
Yeah.
Few things I think people don't realize impact their serviceability, which is so important in this day and age with how high interest rates are. I mean, back 2 years ago, if you were on 100 grand, you could probably borrow $700,000-$800,000. Now you borrow 350. It's halved, yeah. you know? So you don't want to halve that or reduce it any more than you can.
Yeah.
And a big thing would be, I see, is people getting $60,000 car loans and they're on an $80,000 salary.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, it looks great. You've got an Audi. Congratulations. But your repayments are $900 a month. That's $900 a month the bank goes, you can't put that towards a mortgage.
Yeah.
It reduces your borrowing capacity by a ridiculous amount. And it's usually not the size of the loan, but the repayments yeah. that are the big one.
Yeah.
So if your repayments are $100 a month, they're not going to impact you as much as a $900 a month repayment.
Yeah.
But still, I just don't believe that a car loan of that size is something that is going to be assisting you and aiding you in building wealth in your future, especially in our young years. I do find it's the 18 to 22-year-olds that do it the most. They're just yeah. freshly out of school. You don't have to go to uni to have a good job anymore. They go into full-time work and they're excited.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, I'm not going to uni and spending money on a hex debt, so I'm going to get a car. And that's great. But like, I'm still driving a Hyundai i30 that I bought for $5,000.
Yeah.
Like, I don't need anything flashy, but I've got a house worth $1 million.
Exactly.
Like,
exactly,
I'm building yeah. wealth myself. I'll get the car later.
Yeah.
When, in cash. I do believe in car loans at some point. Some people do need cars.
Yeah.
But you don't have to buy an $80,000 car.
Yeah.
So talking about cars, I think I remember doing a post about this a while ago. It probably depends client case by case, but would you suggest someone using, let's just say they've got the cash, would you suggest someone using the cash to buy? Okay, best case scenario, don't buy the $80,000 car.
Yeah, but if they have to, let's just say they need it,
if
whatever.
If they have to and they have chosen to, would you suggest them pay cash for that car loan, would you cash for that car loan so then they don't have any repayments, or would you suggest them put, assuming they can still get finance, put that deposit for a property?
Yep.
And then get a loan for against. The car.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the big thing is cash is king. It's hard to save money, especially in this day and age.
Yeah.
So it's really about what are your future goals. If you're wanting to buy property and your car loan is $60,000, you've got 100 grand in the bank, we're probably going to think that, well, we need that 100 grand for a deposit.
Yeah.
And what you can do, and a strategy that I do employ with a few people once they have the property, is that once you have a little bit of equity in the property, you cash out and you consolidate the car loan into the mortgage. I prefer and I like to make it a separate split on the mortgage, because the thing is your rate will be lower. Instead of paying 10 to 12% on a car loan, you might be paying 5 to 6%.
Yep.
However, 5 to 6% over 30 years is a lot more interest than 10 to 12% over 7 years. So you've got to make sure you're making the exact same repayments on the car loan that you would have been at 10 to 12%
really good
on that split on the mortgage.
Yeah, that's a great tip.
Only something you can do though once you have a property and you've got equity, because a lot of people don't realize when you're buying your first property, you can't borrow more than what the bank is willing to lend you. You can't. A lot of people think they might be able to borrow more for renovations, but I'm like, well, you've got to think, this is a loan, the bank needs to know you're going to pay it back.
Yep.
So that's a risk factor. They can't give you extra on top of what the property is worth, because what if you don't do that, those renovations, and you have to sell and you have a $50,000 shortfall and you have to go bankrupt and the bank's not going to get their money back.
Yep.
All they care is that you're making repayments and you're going to pay them back. That's all they want.
Yep.
So you've got to have the equity first. So if you have to get the property, and you maybe only have $100,000 in cash and that's enough to get you into the property market, you keep the car loan. It's always just assessing what your borrowing capacity is with and without.
Yeah.
Do you need it? And there are a lot of people that come to me before they get the car loan and I'm like, yes, win. Let's chat about the options.
Yeah.
Some people it's too late and they've already got it. And I'm like, would you be willing to sell that car and getting a cheaper one?
Yeah.
And I'm like, and they're like, oh, I'm not sure. I'm like, well, what are your priorities? My priority is to buy a house. I'm like, are you going to do what it's willing, what it needs to take to get there?
Yeah.
So it's really about, that's where I think the holistic perspective comes in of, oh, you want to buy a house? Cool. This is what you've got. This is what you can get. What are your priorities? List them out and make sure you know that, okay, if that's your number one priority, that's what you need to be working towards. I kind of believe in, you might have like five financial goals. You want to invest $20,000 in the share market. You want to buy an investment property. You want to go on a holiday. What order are you going to do those things? Because if you try and do them all at once, you're not going to be as motivated, because as we said at the start, I was really motivated to get my house, but yeah, nothing else mattered. That was my one goal and I was charging towards it. Yeah. 70 hours a week. It's not easy to do for anyone. A lot of people will say that. I don't glamorize hustle culture. It was really hard.
Yeah.
Mm. I was struggling with it. My relationship ended because of it as well. Because I was like, this is my goal. I need to get there. Yeah. Everything else goes in the back end. My mental health took a backseat, like everything. It was hard. I don't know if I'd do it again. I'm proud I did it. Yeah. I probably would never do it again. I'm not going to glamorize it. It was tough work, but you've got to figure out what is that goal and you got to go there, because you can see a light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
If you're working on three or four goals at once and they're all to do with money and you're just putting a little bit into each at a time, you're not going to feel like you're making any progress.
Yeah.
So really choosing what is that goal that is going to get you there. You need the mindset of just focusing on that. Mm-hmm. And then you go to the next goal and then you push that through, and then you go to the next goal and you push that through.
Yeah.
100%. So. I've personally found that as well recently. I've kind of been looking, I actually had a chat with Bobby as well. I've got a few big things, a few big life goals in the pipeline. And I was like, what do I do first? Mm. And when I really sat down and thought about it, it's property is what I want to do first. So I'm saving for my first investment and I'm just going absolutely like gung-ho on it. At the moment, I'm just saving as much as I possibly can, but also having that clarity of that goal and kind of when I want to do it by has just helped me to focus on the step-by-step exact numbers that I have to put aside to get to that.
Yeah, that's what we chatted about. We spoke about that on our call. I'm like, what are your timelines? What do we have right now? And that's where a broken can come in, because, you know, you're like, oh, well, I don't know what I can borrow. I don't know what deposit I need. And I have no idea.
Yeah, having that call quite early on in your thought process can be so helpful as well. So if anyone's looking to get into property or thinking about it, or it's at least on their radar, having a discussion with someone who can show them what is possible and then when is it possible by, it just gives you that clarity. And then also, don't buy that car right now if you can avoid it, like little tips like that. So make sure that you do end up at your goal and you're not going to be blindsided by doing something stupid that you just weren't aware of.
It's a little bit hard when you have a goal and but you don't really know what that goal is. People say they want to buy a house, but they have no idea how to get there. They just need to save. And so that's where that first call to me is so important.
Yeah.
A lot of brokers will only do like a 10 to 20 minute first call with their clients. So I do 45 minutes at least. Sometimes it goes to an hour.
Yeah.
And I send a follow-up email as well with a summary of everything we spoke about.
So your first call is sometimes up to an hour?
Yeah.
Wow.
So a lot of things is that people will just book in with a client. I mean, like, this is me spilling all my secrets, but I don't really care, because I absolutely believe in collaboration, not competition. And I don't really, and I'm like, if someone's going to take notes from this, it's a broker, and employ this with their clients, that's a win for them. 100%. So I have like an online profile, and usually you would fill that out after a first call. I actually get people to fill it out before the call. If you don't fill it out, we reschedule the appointment, because I need you to put in a little bit of effort if I'm going to give you about an hour and a half of my time.
Yeah.
So we'll have that, and it gives me clarity. I can have a research of things before we go on this call. And so I can move into, I can skip all the, where do you live? What do you do for work? Like, how much do you have in savings? What are your assets? That's all. I've already got all that information.
Yeah.
So we can go straight into strategy and like how we're going to get you there faster, going into borrowing capacities, repayments, deposits, the schemes that you're eligible for, the strategy on like your next future property goals and everything as well. So 45 minutes of your time, we're just knocking it all out. People are like, oh, I'm writing all this down. I'm like, don't worry. It's all going to get sent to you with links on like what you can look for and tips and tricks. So I think having clarity and having a position of going, okay, now I know what my goal is. It was before buy a property, but now I've got to save $1,200 a week, or I've got to increase my income somehow, or those kind of things.
Yeah.
So yeah, just knowing exactly what you have to do and the steps you need to take.
The clarity makes it so much more motivating, but also I don't know how other people feel, but I personally felt when my goal was more vague, it seems way more unachievable.
Yeah, absolutely.
And making it achievable is like deciding exactly how much you are going to kind of spend on that property.
Mm.
And then, like we said, work back on that from a timeline perspective of how long it's going to take you to save that. And
for
then
sure.
You look at it and you're like, you know what, that's so achievable. Yep. Rather than, I want to buy a property, and then media is like, property is this much, like crisis, blah, blah, blah. And you take all of that on board and it's like, whoa, I don't even know where to start.
Yeah.
But that's why having that goal and clarity actually makes it way more motivating and way more achievable.
Absolutely, yeah. 100%.
Do you see a different do you see different risk profiles or different goals with
so much
male and females?
Ooh. Recently, no. I've had a few males that have been quite risk adverse.
Okay.
I think it's a lot to do with how you've been brought up,
yeah,
and your 100%. Parents. A few people have golden retriever parents that are like, you can live with me forever, don't stress about it, all good. But then there's some people that have been renting since I was 17 and they're like, I need to get in the property ladder because they know that their rent's been going up constantly. They either want security or they want that for themselves. I do tend to see a lot more women are risk adverse, but I think it's due to a lack of financial literacy and understanding leverage, and that having a mortgage is a good debt.
Yeah.
It's a debt that is going to give you leverage to increase your wealth. But if you have bad debt, like car loans, personal loans, credit cards, all of that, that's obviously where the problem lies.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people that come to me that don't have any debt at all and they're completely debt-free, or they might have a HECS debt, which again is a good debt because that is building for education and you're going to have an income out of that as well. So a lot of women tend to be tend to be more risk adverse.
Yeah.
Which is quite interesting. However, the women are the ones that take charge of the financial household. They're the ones that are filling out that online profile. They're the ones that are handling the conversation. Sometimes the men are there in the background or they're just not even on the call and I just CC them in on that email.
Yeah.
But the women are the ones that know everything, which is so interesting.
I think you're 100% right. It comes down to your upbringing, but it also comes down to what stage in your life you're up to. Like for me personally, I was open to risk and I was a big risk taker and I was happy to have nothing in the account and all in property and have heaps of good debt and almost live week to week as long as I could buy another property. That was what I lived like until I had my first child.
Mm.
And then you have your different first child change, eh? And now I'm just like, yeah. I don't
security.
Want
stability.
Yeah, I just want stability
for the baby.
Yeah, exactly.
The family.
So it comes down to what stage you are and in your life as well.
A lot of single people are way more risk tolerant. They're like, I don't have anything to track me down or keep me tied up.
Yeah.
All my money can go into property, like you said, Bobby.
Yeah.
So I find that that's really interesting. Also, if people are living out of home or at home is interesting. If people are living at home and they're willing to live at home for a while, they'll go straight into investments. They won't look at buying a property to live in because they're comfortable where they are and their parents will support them. And that's amazing. That's a huge leg up.
Lucky.
Yeah. But then if you have some people that like couples tend to be a little bit risk adverse, like one of them, it's usually, I feel like opposites attract in every sense. Like, and generally a lot, it's the man that's like, buy whatever we want, all good. And the woman's like, oh, mortgage. And yeah, when you have any debt, and I can tell if someone has no debt, I'm like, you're risk adverse. I can tell straight away before I even get on the call.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's the thing, I've got to gauge it because I do have some clients, then they're ready on paper to buy property. They've got the deposit, they've got the income, not mentally ready. They're terrified. And that's
what can help people get mentally ready in your opinion?
Financial literacy.
Yeah.
Understanding it's not actually a scary thing.
100%.
Going through what repayments will be, what's your life going to look like, is a really big thing. So I generally, especially if it's a home to live in, I go, what's your rent and what are you saving? Combine those two, technically that's what you're putting away. But I want you to put on top at least like $200 a week for extra repayments of having a house, especially if you're renting. You're not going to have council, water rates, body corp, all those kind of things.
Yeah.
But then you've got travel, you've got kids, you've got all those other extra expenses to pay for. So you've got a budget and buffer. It's not just what the bank's going to loan you, but what's affordable for your lifestyle. You don't want to have a house and not be able to do anything with it and just be sitting in a house going, yeah, I've got a mortgage, but I'm miserable. Like that's not what property is about.
Exactly.
So it's making sure things are affordable and I guess just giving people clarity on what their life and their money is going to look like once they have a property. And people then tend to be a bit more like, okay, this makes sense. I'm excited. I'm motivated. Like, let's do it.
Yeah.
But sometimes people just need that foundation of going, okay, I want a house, but I'm scared to have a mortgage.
Yeah.
Mm.
What does this look like? And if it's an investment going, hey, well, your repayments are going to be $800 a week, but $700 is going to be covered by rent and this property is going to go up in value. It's in a great spot. It's got amenities. It's, you know, the capital growth potential is there. People are like, oh, that doesn't really feel like much of a risk.
Exactly. Yeah. I've actually had that conversation with a few clients where, especially since interest rates have risen, they've looked at, because we break down the numbers to a very detailed outline of what their net cash flow will look like. And sometimes they look at that figure for the year and they're like, I can't afford to be negative X amount. And then when you break it down and paint it in a picture of maybe savings, so most of the time we can buy property still like around the 200, I would say 200, 100 to $200 a week negative.
I thought you were going to say $200,000 purchase. And I was like, damn, oh, where are you going to buy?
So like $100 or $200 a week negative.
Yeah.
And if you ask most people if they can honestly save that amount of money, the answer for most people would be yes.
Yeah.
So if you can save that amount, why not have that amount in negative gearing? So negative cash flow for the property. Great tax return, but then also like what they're gaining off of that is more than what they would be gaining in interest rates putting that $200 in the bank.
Absolutely.
So you're getting what, at least 10% growth on a property if you buy smartly, and what, 5% if you're lucky on a, that money in the bank. So it just makes a massive difference. So when you paint it in that picture, a lot of people are like, oh, okay, I can actually afford that negative gearing.
10% on a $500,000 property is 50 grand.
Exactly.
5% on a $50,000 in bank is $2,500.
One leverage.
Yeah. Yes. That's all it is. If it's costing you $10,000 to hold onto it, but you're making $50,000 in equity, it's a no-brainer as long as you can.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can claim it as tax-deductible, as you said.
Yeah, and when your income starts to get higher, those tax deductions on negative gearing are a great thing. And a lot of people don't realise what positive or negative gearing is.
Yeah.
I don't believe in severely negatively geared properties.
No, we definitely don't as well. And I think we've spoken about that as well, is making sure you're not too negative so you can't borrow again. And obviously, as interest rates reduce, will help people substantially. We'll be able to probably get positively geared again, hopefully, once those interest rates come back down. But if you kind of work from the worst case scenario on interest rates, and if you can afford that, then it's only going to be like plain,
we're in
simple
the average
from there forward. Yeah.
On that, do you think this is worst case scenario interest rates at the moment?
At the moment, yes. But I think our average over the last 30 years has been 5 to 7%. I don't think we're going to ever really see 2% again. That was an anomaly, and I think that's what a lot of people are like. Rates are so expensive. When's it going to go back to 2%? I'm like, forget about
it.
It's not going to happen. And I don't really believe in trying to time the market and going, I want to wait till rates drop, or I want to wait till this, or when property prices drop, you buy when you're ready to buy on paper. When your income and your deposit is ready, that's when you go. And we already know that there's going to be about 2 rate cuts priced in by the end of the year. I don't believe there's going to be any more rate rises this year. Inflation is still increasing, but at a slower rate. So we had it at 4.1% this month. The target is 2 to 3% by the RBA. It's on its way down without more rate rises. So I don't believe there's going to be more rate rises this year. However, as rates start to decrease, borrowing capacity increases, because your exact same repayments will be giving you more. So in that sense, there's going to be a lot more buyer confidence in the market. So I'm telling people, is it worth waiting for if you have the income right now, especially for investment properties, because you really don't need a lot of income yourself. A lot of people that have the $70,000 income, they will buy investments. And I'm like, well, if you could buy now for a $500,000 property at a 6.2, 6.5% interest rate, by the end of the year into next year, the rate might come down to 5, 5.5%. You're taking advantage of the capital growth in that time and the lower repayments. And compared to when the buyers start coming and flooding the market again because their borrowing capacity is up there, that property might now be worth $550,000 to $600,000 at that lower rate. They may be able to afford it, but your property is now going to be worth an extra 100 grand and you still get the lower repayments now.
Yeah, that's exactly the conversation we have with a lot of people who say, oh, we just want to wait until interest rates go down.
Property is going to go up in
we
price.
Say, well, you're paying an extra 10% for that property at that stage. So if you can afford it now, then you might as well get in. And just this year alone, we've seen a massive increase in leads and also in clients that have come on board. Are you seeing a larger volume this year in comparison to the back end of last year?
Yeah, I mean, end of last year, usually springtime is when people are buying their properties to live in. January, people are all flooding to be like, I'm ready, 2024 is my year to buy property. So I may have people that are coming in that are not ready to buy yet. They're a couple of maybe 6 to 12 months away. But then giving them that clarity of this is where you want to be, and going, if you think you want to buy in July, well, we need to start backtracking and we need to get you pre-approval before that, because a pre-approval lasts you 3 to 4 months. And then, well, if we want a pre-approval by that date, then we need to start working. We need to get you, you know, submitting a pre-approval 2 weeks prior. We need to start chatting about it like a week or two prior to that. So it's all backtracking and working. But I am telling people, if you really want to buy this year, try and buy before everyone starts flooding the market. It's smart.
And another thing that may cause an influx in interest in the market is tax cuts. Come the end of the financial year, people are going to have more disposable income because mid to high income earners are going to be taxed less than what they currently are. So That's going to leave more money in their pocket. Again, serviceability will go up and then more people will enter the market. So it's only just going to push prices up higher. So if you can get in now, I'd say 100% do it.
The government, they've got interest in property. Yeah. They don't want the prices to go down. So why would you wait for them to go down? And if the prices are going down, they're going down to the point that you want them going down, then it's probably not a good investment if it's going to keep going down. So you don't want the market to go down.
There was an interview with Harry Triguboff and Aaron Molan, and he said his business partners, he goes, I'm in the best industry that you could imagine. My business partners are the government and the banks. It's not going to fail.
No.
Yeah.
And he's
absolutely. You know, and if it fails, we've got more important things to worry about. So
exactly. Yeah. Well, I think the property market is three times larger than, or property market's about $10 trillion in Australia, and super is $3 trillion.
It's insane, isn't it?
So it's, you know, more than three times the value of super. So it's too big to fail. And we saw that when COVID hit and they propped up, you know, rent freezes, mortgage freezes, helping everyone that had mortgages.
They won't ever.
So we saw it.
We're not going to have that problem that we had in the GFC. We're not going to have people handing in their keys. The banks want you to pay that mortgage back, and they will do everything they can to make that happen, even if it means putting you in financial hardship on interest-only repayments. They don't want to have to take in that property and then have to sell it and probably at a loss. Yeah. They don't want that. The banks don't want that. They want to make money off you, and they want you to be a customer as long as possible.
Yeah.
We're in a completely different market to what we were like in 2008.
Yeah.
So I don't ever believe that the property market is going to crash, essentially. And I don't think that the government's going to let that happen. We've now got Help to Buy schemes, which I don't believe in. But we've got so many opportunities for first home buyers to get into the market now.
Yeah.
Investors as well. They have a great opportunities, and we can pay lenders mortgage insurance. We can get you in earlier with a smaller deposit. There is that risk versus reward and opportunity costs of potentially higher interest rates and paying extra fees, but it gets you in the market faster. Capital growth is the king, to be honest, in property. So
all these incentives they're putting in place is just adding fuel to the fire, and letting in 500,000 people a year net is what's propping up the property market at the moment.
It's hard. Like, you've got a lot of migration and immigration. And there's just such a rental crisis everywhere, which pushes people to want to buy, which pushes the prices up. And especially going out, like where I live in Queensland, in Southeast Queensland, we've got a lot of Sydney and Melbourne owners.
Those
sell
Sydney siders.
So, I know, right? You guys will sell your property for $2 million and then buy a house worth $800,000 for $1 million up north, because you can in cash. Yeah. So like things like that. And, you know, especially where I live in the Gold Coast, Southeast Queensland market's quite propped up with all the money and infrastructure and amenities happening with the games, with the Olympic Games coming up in 2032.
Yeah.
So we've got a lot of growth there in the market at the moment too.
Yeah, quiet. Sorry, you're going to say something, Christy?
Yeah, no, it was kind of a little bit backtracking off what you said before about interest only. And I was just kind of, it stuck in my head, because I think a lot of people, and it's probably a good question for you, a lot of people don't understand the difference between an interest only loan and a principal and interest loan. Mm. So what's your thoughts on that in terms of investments, buying your first home? Have you got any advice? I know what I think, but I would like to hear it from you in terms of what you think. If someone was buying an investment, for instance, what kind of loan would you suggest for them?
So fun. I love this. This is strategy stuff. Yeah. And so I get to sit down with clients and just write out, like, this is your house now, this is your next house, that kind of thing. It all comes down to what your goals are. Obviously, I feel like that's the answer to every question. Yeah. So principal and interest means that you're making repayments on the principal part of the loan that you're borrowing. So your mortgage will slowly go down. Interest only means that every month, as interest gets added back to the loan, that's the only thing you're paying. So your actual debt doesn't decrease, but your cash flow is increased because your repayments are lower. Now, principal and interest versus interest only does decrease your borrowing capacity slightly, because say you make the loan interest only for 2 or 5 years, your principal repayments will be over 25 years instead of 30 years. And so therefore your borrowing capacity goes down, because after the interest only period ends, your repayment's going to be higher than if they were over 30 years.
Unless you refinance, correct?
Exactly. So what we do with a lot of clients is there'll be 2 or 5 years interest only. That obviously a capital growth continue going, then we refinance them to interest only again. We just keep going. And generally when you're younger and you're more like you're happy with debt, you are happy with leverage, interest only is a great way to work towards it. You may only be paying $100 or $200 less a fortnight or week on your repayments, but $100 a week When you have that extra cash flow, it's $5,000 a year over 2-3 years, it's an extra $15,000 you can put towards your next investment property or purchase. So all comes down to, what are your goals? Is cash flow important to you? Because generally it is, it'll help things be a little bit more positively geared. And instead of putting that money more into a mortgage and reducing that debt, can we use that extra cash to help leverage you for another property? Because we can't just rely on capital growth. If there's not going to be a lot of capital growth in one area, then cool. Well, now we've got a deposit to land on as well. So most of the time when you've got one property and want to buy another, we will split interest only. Obviously, when it's a property you're living in and owner-occupied debt, that is not tax deductible. So we want to reduce that as much as possible. So if you've got a property you're living in and an investment, I want it to be interest only on the investment, because that's all tax deductible debt. Yeah. And that way, all that extra cash can be funneled into your owner-occupied debt that's not tax deductible. Yeah. That's generally the way it works. And then you funnel that in, and then you can, all that money going into the either the offset account or into the actual loan, reducing the debt on the owner-occupied property. You then take out that extra debt in equity on that property as an investment, interest only again, buy your next one. The goal is to keep debt recycling and making non-tax deductible debt tax deductible, either through shares or property. So you want to leverage debt as much as possible, and have increased cash flow to reduce non-deductible debt.
We've often had the question of, if I'm only paying interest only, like, how am I ever going to pay off the debt? And I suppose
capital gains.
That's right. So yeah, we always have that conversation, and people don't really think about that. And it's the capital gains that you're getting on the property that's eventually going to help you pay down the debt on few of your properties, which is obviously then going to release the cash flow. So it's more of a long-term way of thinking. So if you can go interest only and pay the smallest amount possible on your repayments, then, well, obviously everyone's different, like you say, but on the whole, that's going to allow you to.
Absolutely. And if the capital growth is there, then generally your rental yield will go up.
Yeah.
And to the point where the property will be self-sufficient, and we can go, all right, well, we're happy to make it principal and interest. We can alleviate some of serviceability there. Yeah. Now we can make that, that's fully covering itself and you're making some money on it. Cool. Yeah. Let's make it principal and interest now. And then you can start paying down the debt when you're comfortable.
Yeah, that's exactly aligned with what we say as well, because like you said, that rent's going to go up. So when you go P&I, it'll cover those costs anyway. Mm. Yeah. But also the value of debt decreases over time as well.
Exactly.
So, you know, imagine if you bought a $500,000 house in the Gold Coast 10 years ago, or $400,000 house in the Gold Coast 10 years ago, and you never paid down a cent of that loan. Now that property is worth $1 million. Mm-hmm. And if you've got a $400,000 debt attached to it, it's nominal.
Yeah, exactly. And then it can be paying itself off. So the goal is kind of be interest only as much as possible. You accumulate that wealth, you accumulate those properties. And then once you're happy and you're like, yeah, I'm really happy where I'm at, my cash flow, I'm really comfortable with, I want to make them all principal and interest, and we can start paying down the debt. Because at the end of the day, most people don't want to sell properties. They can, but you know, you want to hold them and then they can become passive income for you for that generational wealth in the future for your retirement and your kids.
Yeah,
that's the aim of the game at the end of the day.
What are you seeing at the moment with your leads that are, or your clients that is, or leads or clients that you're speaking with that are, that's the biggest challenge?
Serviceability, borrowing capacity. It's a big one. Especially if it's, so usually there's the two scenarios. You're buying a property to live in, or you're buying an investment. Property to live in, usually you've got all these grants and schemes available for you, 5% deposit plus costs, no lender's mortgage insurance, all that kind of thing. The issue is borrowing capacity and serviceability because the rates are so high. Opposite is true with investments, because you can use the rental income as proposed income to help pay off the loan.
Yep.
The issue is the deposit, because you don't have all those schemes. You usually be sitting at around a 12 to 15% deposit when you include all costs.
Yep.
Pay lender's mortgage insurance. You've got stamp duty. You've also got a slightly higher interest rate, and then it can be even higher with interest only as well. So in that sense, when it's from an investment perspective, it ends up being the deposit that's the issue, which is what we were seeing with you as well. Mm. And then when it's owner occupied, it's the income. So that's the two big things that are factoring at the moment. Interest rates are really killing everything. But I like to always frame it in a good way. I'm like, this is what rates normally are. You could be like me, where my repayments were $500 a week 2 years ago. They're now $950 a week. I'm struggling. I'm sure most of Australia is struggling.
Yep.
I didn't expect to be in this position. And if I had my time again, I would have been a bit smarter about it. Again, grateful for what I've got, but it's hard. So, if now people are like, this is where my repayments are at, this is the worst case scenario, to be honest, for the short term and for the next couple of years, great. If you can afford this, that's amazing. Because as the repayments go down, keep making those repayments and you'll feel comfortable, or alleviate your cash flow to buy another property. I think it's a good thing. People are not overextending themselves. They're not allowed to in this market.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think the big thing would be is it's either – for owner-occupied, it's deposit and saving, because cost of living is a struggle right now. If it's investment, it's the income and increasing your income. So that's where buyer's agents like yourselves can come in and have really strong rental yields for that first property. And buying a smaller size property, taking the emotion out of it, is such a big one.
Yeah.
So I'm curious as to when you were buying your first one, and obviously all of these brokers, which makes zero sense to me that none of them actually advise you to potentially buy an investment first. Or
no one talks about strategy.
What was your position back then and your reason for buying that PPR first rather than an investment? Is it just a lack of guidance, or?
It was an emotional piece.
Okay.
I struggle with stability in every area of my life, yeah. Which is ironic because now I'm a broker and technically brokers work off just commissions. So it's funny how that works. But it was just an emotional thing. I was scared to rent. My parents, and like I think it just works off what you're used to with your family. Yeah. And I didn't want to essentially be like my parents were. My parents never spoke about money. They fought about money all the time.
Yeah.
They would never tell me anything about incomes or mortgages, the credit card debts they were in, anything. And I was always so curious about it. My dad's an accountant.
Yeah.
Ironically, sometimes people that work in finance are the worst with money. And he's good with money, but just in terms of like the big purchases and things like that, it's just they weren't smart about it. And I've just always had this, I think it's honestly just a thing from my childhood and a lack of, I guess, emotional stability, that I sought stability in every area of my life. And that was why I wanted to buy a house to live in.
Yep.
But I didn't want to buy a unit. I was like, I know in my head what's a good investment. So let's use a buyer's agent, take the emotion out of it and buy something that I know is going to go up in value. It has.
Yep.
My buyer's agent was 15 grand. My property's gone up 300 grand in 2 years. Like,
so good.
It paid itself off tenfold. I wholeheartedly believe in what you guys do.
Yeah.
And especially if I'm speaking to someone that is wanting to buy an investment property and I'm like, oh, have you considered buying outside of your suburb? And I'm like, what? No.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you can buy for way cheaper or just a better, like, you know, we buy properties every day. This is what we do every single day, but you haven't bought a property in your life. You've barely gone to any open homes. You don't know what to look for.
Yeah.
And this is the biggest purchase you're going to make.
Yeah.
Until you buy your next one. Yeah. But like, you know, you need to make sure you're doing the right thing, and having those experts that do it day in, day out is so important. So overall, it was an emotional thing. If I had my time again, I'd probably buy an investment first, because I didn't get access to any of the schemes because I bought too high.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
I suppose that's where those schemes can have their benefit in buying PPR first in some instances, just to get people into the market a bit sooner.
Absolutely.
But it just depends, again, where do you buy? Because if it's, let's say, Sydney – where my serviceability would sit me is a one-bedroom unit. I don't want to buy one-bedroom unit.
Sydney is just so no point.
I think in that instance, rent vesting becomes a better opportunity. And that's where, for me personally, I think a lot of women particularly, and I think men do it as well, but society tells you should buy a house to live in, and you grow up with this picture of buying a house where your family.
Exactly.
And I think
I learned
that draws emotion as well.
Yep.
And I think that also that stumps people, because if that is totally out of reach, it's like, what do you do first to get you there?
Yep.
And that's where the investment property is really useful. So that's the strategy that I'll be going with, is trying to figure out a blend of what I can afford, where I can afford it, and working up from there to eventually be able to get the capital growth to buy that dream home.
Absolutely.
My future. But in on that topic, what's your thoughts on rent vesting, and if you want to, what experience have you had with clients that are rent vesting? Have you got any particular scenarios or stories that you can kind of give us that, I don't know, a little bit juicy, people can relate to?
Yeah, absolutely. I wholeheartedly believe in rent vesting, or staying with your parents and living at home. I think that it's a way to get into the market. And a lot of people now, when, you know, incomes and wages aren't increasing as fast as property is, how can we get into the market and continue to get into the market? A lot of the times I'm getting a lot of first home property buyers that are going, all right, let's divert. We thought we were going to buy a property to live in, but you know what? I'm happy where I am. I don't want to move out of the suburb I'm in. So let's buy an investment property. And then I just make sure they're not capping out their borrowing capacity for their first purchase so they can then buy their next ones and they can keep that going. And then, like you said, you have two or three under your belt. You've got good rental yields on them. The capital growth has gone up. Enough equity. Take that equity out. Deposit for your property to live in. Yeah. So people are kind of doing the opposite of what they used to and what I thought I was going to do. So I thought my PPOR, my capacity is capped out.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got nothing now that the rates have gone up. So I can't, but I've got so much equity, I can't take it out yet.
Yeah. On the plus side, so when interest rates drop, you'll have the equity and you'll be able to as well.
So to me, it's the borrowing capacity. And when you buy a property to live in because there's no rental income supporting it, your borrowing capacity is shot. Mm. So a lot of people are doing the opposite now. They buy several investment properties and then they will either sell or they will just take out the equity to help support their purchase to live in. The end of the Australian dream is what everyone wants to do. So yeah,
sure. And how many properties would you say that typically people would need to buy in terms of investments to be able to have enough capital growth to buy their
number
their
of home? Properties is a hard one because it's all to do with where you're buying value and your capital growth. Yeah. Like you could have a property you've bought that's $700,000, it's only gone up by 50 grand, but you could buy a $350,000 property, it's gone up by 150.
Yeah.
So it's not usually to do with the number of properties. The less the better, because obviously it's expensive to buy property.
Yeah.
You've got stamp duty, you've got fees, you've got rates, you've got everything.
So maintenance and
It's expensive to hold a property as an investment. It's a good investment, but it's expensive. So the less you can have, the better. In terms of, I guess, that capital growth to use for investment, for a property to live in. But I mean, generally people will go with two or three. Most people don't want to have like a 20 property portfolio investment. There's a lot of those people out there that say, here's how you can own a $40 million property portfolio, blah, blah, blah. But the everyday person doesn't want that. They just want to be able to live comfortably and have money that's passive income for them in retirement and to support their family.
Yeah. We tell people, the goal should be, or if the goal is to buy a principal place of residence after reinvesting for a prolonged period of time, you should try to get the value of your investment portfolio at least to the same size as the value of your PPOR in the current market.
Absolutely.
Because let's assume all markets move the same, at least you're keeping up.
Yes.
But if you're buying good investments, hopefully your investment portfolio outgrows. Then the PPOR. So that's what we generally tell people.
It's a good
people.
Rule of thumb. Yeah.
But it is case by case and there's quite a few variables. Talking about incentives with my first property going back way long ago.
Don't even tell me how much you bought it for. I don't want to know.
It was in Sydney and it was an apartment. It was off the plan. It was had like a spa, had a pool, had a gym, had all the maintenance costs, had manicured gardens. It was the what not to do of investment properties.
Yeah, it sounds like
from what we tell people
how
now.
How much is that body corp?
It's the what not to do, but I didn't know that at that stage. The benefit was at that stage I was able to get in with a 5% deposit, live in it for 6 months, and 5% deposit, no stamp duty, live in it for 6 months, no capital gains. So they're the benefits. And I guess the reason I'm sharing that story is for those people listening that are thinking of getting into the property market and don't know whether to go down the incentive route or not.
Yeah.
That property over 10 years probably grew only about 3 or 4% per year.
Yeah.
So performed under the Australian average. But at that stage, it was the only time I could get into the market. Mm-hmm. So I got my foot on
the ladder. Foot in the door. That's the hardest part.
But if I had my time again and if I could have afforded to just buy a great performing investment property, my sister and I purchased that for $500,000 approximately. If we had bought a $500,000 property that grew at 10%, it probably would have been worth $1.2 million.
That's why I bought such a high price when I did. I was like, I'm not going to buy a unit.
Yeah.
But there are ways of, going in with siblings, going in with friends now. You can go on the schemes with your friends through the first home guarantee schemes. So that's that 5% deposit. A lot of people do that. They go, I'm going to live in it for 6 months. I'm going to go back to my parents and then make an investment. You avoid stamp duty. You avoid paying lenders, mortgage insurance, all of that, which is great.
Yeah.
But you can also do something now because they know it's so popular that people are just going in together to buy property. It's called like a property share. Yep. So that's where you can split the mortgage into two. Because the big issue is when you bought with your sister, you're both on the mortgage.
Yep.
But if one of you wanted to go buy another property, you're liable for that entire mortgage in the bank's eyes. You can't split it into two.
That's right.
So what I do with a lot of siblings is I go, okay, well, you're both on the mortgage. There's a full $400,000 loan right now.
Yeah.
one wants to go buy more property, one's like, nah, I'm happy. Well, then that person, that sibling one, is going to be liable for that full $400,000 in the bank size, destroys borrowing capacity. Yep. So what you can do is you can split the mortgage into two with some banks. You both are liable for $200,000 each. You both don't see the other $200,000. It's just in your separate banks. They're separate applications. But what you do is you're a guarantor on each of your applications.
Interesting.
So I will have that $200,000 and then you will guarantee that to other $200,000.
Yeah.
Okay. So if I stop paying the loan, you've got to pay it. Same with how there's the parental guarantors.
Yeah.
There will still be a default. So there's still a liability there. But because I'm only liable essentially for my portion of the loan, the other banks don't have to worry about the other 200 grand that my other sibling has. So that's called a property share.
Was this available back in the day as well, or is this a new
thing? Back then. No, yeah. It's probably been like last five years.
Interesting.
More and more banks are coming on board. So like ING and CBA are the two that do it well at the moment. But you can only really split it two ways. Same thing if like parents want to go in with their kids, but they want to be on title separately, it has to match up with whatever's on the title. So it's 50-50.
Yeah.
So we'll have some cases where the parents want to put in 50% for their like part. They won't even put the mortgage on, but they want to be on the title. And then the other kids take the other 50%. But then, that's called a property share as well. It doesn't matter how much cash. And then that way you guys can pay it off as fast or as little as you want. If you were earning 100 grand and I was earning 150, I want to pay that mortgage off faster.
Yeah.
I can pay off my 200 grand faster than you.
Yeah.
So it's a great way to get in, is going in with friends or family. And now you can take advantage of all these schemes. You don't have to have just yourself or a de facto partner.
Yeah.
You can have anyone come on the scheme with you. You can split the loan into two and you both can be still technically liable for each other's if you stop paying, but it's better than having a mortgage together. That way
it doesn't get mixed
and it's funny.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt you. That liability then isn't it doesn't affect your serviceability.
It doesn't affect your borrowing capacity. Even though you're a guarantor.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's pretty cool. So that's a way to do it. So that's why I'm doing it at the moment with the client. They're structuring it because one of the siblings wants to buy another property, but the other's like, I'm fine. But instead of being liable for 400 grand, she's liable for 200. So her borrowing capacity goes up by heaps.
That's the importance of having a good broker that knows the different lenders and their tools and how they can benefit you.
We have 60. We have 60 on our panel.
Wow.
And we have to know everyday things change. And you got to know each of the policies for each of those banks. If you go to, say, Commonwealth Bank, they're only going to tell you their own policies and if you fit it or not. But I have so many other lenders that I have an opportunity at my fingertips to be able to go, no, this, and that's where rate is and everything.
Yeah.
And sometimes definitely. The big four have a bigger rate. Their rates are more expensive and their costs are more expensive. So like Commonwealth Bank, Commonwealth Bank and Westpac, $395 annual package fee. But some banks have no fees.
Yeah.
Some have upfront fees, I love it. So when I have my second meeting with a client, I screen time with them. I share my screen and I show them a table breakdown of their three to four options.
Yeah.
I'm like, look how much higher that rate is, but look how over the next 5 years, its cost is lower, less fees. Like fees pay a big difference. But also like when you think of offset accounts, do you want one or do you want multiple? Are you happy with none? Like if it's going to be investment, do you need an offset account?
Yeah.
You probably don't because you want to have as much tax deductible debt as possible.
Yeah.
So like there's so many ways that come into it, but that's why strategy is so important.
Yeah.
And when you have a broker that can do literally everything for you, I think 80% of loans now are written by brokers. And I think that number's only getting higher.
And to think a few years ago, the banks were trying to remove mortgage brokers out of the industry. That would have been a very dangerous step.
It's very dangerous. I think that would have been a massive problem and all the other banks would have fallen away because the big four are the only ones that can really.
Monopoly.
Yeah. Sure. And they can, it's literally a game of Monopoly.
Yeah.
It literally is.
Yeah.
So.
I want to go back to a post I saw that you did recently in regards to the average mortgage repayments being about 30 or 40%.
Mm.
What's yours?
80. Without my sublets, yeah.
So 80.
It was 30%. It was, but I also wasn't smart. Where I switched careers when I decided to have my house. I bought my house. I was like, this is awesome. I had a crappy process, but I loved what I could potentially do for people.
Yeah.
So I switched careers while I had a mortgage and then rates went up. It wasn't a smart decision when I think about it. But yeah, it's now 80%. So like usually there is that standard of about 30% of your income is usually it's net income is what is comfortable. Anything above that, you're in what's called mortgage stress. I'm stressed.
I think most people at the moment are with interest rates at the rate they are, they would be in mortgage stress.
Absolutely. People that are borrowing and buying right now probably aren't in mortgage stress because the banks aren't going to lend them more than that. Yep. But people that are in what we call mortgage prison, where they can't refinance to any other lenders, they're stuck where they are because their borrowing capacity is lower than what their actual mortgage is.
Yeah.
There's a few ways around it, which is quite interesting. So for instance, ANZ have a process called Simpler Switch, where if your 24 months of credit history on your credit report is perfect and you're going to be refinancing for lower repayments than your current mortgage, they won't look at anything.
Interesting.
From a compliance perspective, it's a bit weird. and like, but like it kind of makes sense from a bank's perspective. If they're making these repayments at say $1,700 a fortnight and we're going to be then with us, they'll be paying $1,650 and they've been perfect at $1,700. Well, why wouldn't we take them?
Exactly. Yeah. It makes sense.
But, you know, when there's that just it's a bit of a grey line for me. I think it's a bit weird from a compliance perspective, but there is that option. A lot of lenders are doing what's called 1% buffers now or 2% buffers on a refinance instead of the usual 3%. Yeah. But I don't want them to reduce the buffers because I want people to not be borrowing and extending themselves to the max. It's important to make sure that you have affordability when you've got mortgage repayments. So I don't want them to reduce that by any means. But when you've already got the mortgage, you know, there's that. But banks will work with you, essentially.
Yeah, and I think the importance of going back to you said your mortgage repayments are 80% of the income at the moment. I think the importance of having goals and clear goals and being so motivated to reach something, you're not going to easily let that go.
No.
A lot of people that if you had come across that house easily and you didn't work 70 hours a week for that house, you might have just said, fuck it, I'm going to sell.
Exactly. Like, it's my baby. I'm not going to let that go. Yeah. And it cost me a lot of money to get into it and a lot of hard work, sweat and tears.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to let it go. People are going to cut away every other area of their life before housing.
Yeah, especially if they've worked as hard as they have to get that goal. They'll like, do everything they can.
I will live off baked beans and toast before I sell my house. And that's what most people like too, like living the Australian dream, I guess. Like having stability and security in housing is such a big part of our Australian culture. So it's something that people aren't going to let go of, which also adds to the property market and how it's not going to drop because people refuse to get out of it.
Yeah.
And once they're in, so.
And also I suppose as we've seen in Sydney and by the sounds of it in Gold Coast as well, like leaving that doesn't actually leave you that much better off if you go into renting. It does. Like obviously it's cheaper to rent in most areas than it is to have your mortgage, but
The moment,
difference is probably nominal, especially with the rental crisis. So if someone's looking to sell, they're like, well,
where do I go?
Where do I go? If I want to rent, I'm going to have to go move somewhere else. Yeah. And that's where we look at like areas that you're looking at affordability because when people can't afford their mortgage, then they're going to go somewhere that's affordable.
Yeah.
And that's where those affordable areas tend to have the capital growth. So
absolutely.
That's kind of how the cycles work where these areas such as Sydney, which have those high debt to income ratios where people potentially do need to sell to move into a more affordable area, they still can't even afford the rents in that area. So where do they move? They move to an affordable area and that increases capital growth. So that's a big determining factor of like where we buy property. But it's interesting from the perspective of, like you say, people are not going to let it go because one, it's emotional. Two, they've worked hard for it. But three, what is the solution if they do sell?
Absolutely. I don't know why that just reminded me. I didn't even answer your question on like a scenario of someone who's bought. So, I mean, we obviously have a shared client as well and someone who bought an investment property a year ago, not even a year ago. Property has gone up over $150,000 in value.
Yeah.
She doesn't need to take out any cash from her savings to purchase her next property, next investment. So nothing. Jealous. 1 year. That's impressive. 1 year is insane turnaround. Think about buying one property a year, you're pretty solid in five years' time.
Yeah.
And I think that was where she was on interest only for all debts. We're actually buying this next property at a 90% loan to value ratio. And the reason being is so we can get in faster. Actually, no, we're buying at 80%. We were thinking 90, but the valuations came back so strong that we didn't have to. We could take out enough equity.
Amazing.
But even then, if you buy at 90%, there is strategy where you do have to pay lenders mortgage insurance. I think of it as an opportunity cost. Yep. But something that I found out, which a lot of brokers don't know anyway, and I do love to educate people on, there is something called a lender's mortgage insurance refund. So if you, that premium, say it's $10,000 and you have to pay that upfront when you buy a property.
The LMI.
Yeah, LMI. It is technically capitalized in a loan size, but you actually tend to actually have to pay it up front. It's just a terminology that I won't go into. But when you have then refinanced away in this person's scenario, if they had bought at 90%, and in my scenario where I bought at a 90% LVR, my property capital growth has gone up exorbitantly. Within a year, I refinanced. And because you're paying a premium on a bank that is then paying their insurer for if there's not enough value in a property, basically the reason there's LMI is because if you sell and there's not enough money in the sale to pay the loan back, they obviously, you go bankrupt, they need to recoup their funds.
Yeah.
That's where LMI comes from. So when you have refinanced within a year of paying that premium, they're like, well, we don't need to pay this premium anymore. Let me refund some of it back to you. So 40% within a year, 20% within 2 years.
Is that all banks?
No. No.
Does Combank? Personal. My mind's going personal.
CBA, unfortunately, no. Okay. So actually, Westpac does, ANZ, NAB do not. So there's two major insurers for the banks. There's Genworth and QBE.
Yeah.
A lot of the big four, they're self-insured, so they can choose. So like there's Westpac who are self-insured, ANZ is self-insured, they'll do it. Yeah. But Bank West, who's owned by Commonwealth Bank, do it. And they're the ones that I went through, and they're the ones that refunded me.
Sure.
I got a letter in the mail, and I was like, Bank West, I'm not with you anymore. Okay. And then they're like, we've refunded you $6,000. And I was like, what? Sorry, why? They're like, well, you've left us and we don't need to pay this premium anymore. So here's your refund because we didn't have to pay all our premiums.
So good.
I wasn't banking with Bank West because I just had my normal banking. I didn't have any offset accounts or anything. So I was just banking with my home loan for Bank West.
Yeah.
So I went into my app and I was like, what? This can't be true. There was the $6,000 right there.
Wow.
So and I was like, no way. I felt like I won the lottery. And it was amazing. Put it right into shares. It was great. But it was like, that was something that I was like, how does no one know about this?
Yeah, I'd never heard about that either.
No. And a lot of brokers haven't. And I was like, stupid thing for them to do. Like, I'm going to tell everyone.
Yeah.
And I now tell everybody, and that's like a strategy. And the thing is, a lot of brokers won't tell you because within 2 years, we're going to get a clawback on our commissions.
Mm.
But I think that's, again, why I got into this industry is I'm not doing something for myself. Yeah. I'm not in this for money. I'm in this to make sure you're getting the best experience and you're getting know the most that you can.
Yeah.
So I'm telling people on calls, I'm like, we'll refinance to you within a year. Sure, I'm going to lose my entire commission and everything I earn, but you're going to be in a better position. So why would I not do that for you?
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, best interest duty only lasts until settlement. So I only really, like a broker only really has to work in your best interest until the loan settles.
Is that right?
Yes.
Interesting.
And I don't like that at all. I mean, while there's an active application is when best interest duty lasts.
Interesting.
I don't believe in that at all. I'm working your best interest forever.
What happens if you feel like your broker is not working in your best interest? What can people do? Because I know a few instances where I've seen brokers really not work in the client's best interest, and it's quite eye-opening and scary because there's so much riding on that finance.
Absolutely. And I think that it's really important to know, like, to feel confident and comfortable. The amount of people that message me on Instagram going, hey, my broker said this. I feel too nervous to ask them or clarify. And I'm like, that's not the right broker for you then.
Yeah.
Like,
so true.
It's sad. I'm like, if you don't feel comfortable asking these silly or what you think is a silly question to a broker, one, a broker should never make you feel like any question silly. They should always make you feel comfortable and that the part of everything in the process you understand in complete confidence. If you don't understand, you're not educated on the process, they're not the right broker for you. Mm-hmm. And the problem is there's not enough there's not enough obstacles or hurdles to get into broking. It's the same with real estate agents. You do a small course and then you're in.
Yeah.
And I don't like that. There should be a lot more, you know, resistance on becoming a broker. And that's why I went through so many. There's a lot of good brokers out there. There's a lot of, every industry, I guess.
And you'd think that with the clawback that they'd have a lot more good brokers.
Well, a lot of them will just do a 2-year or 3-year fixed rate. You're stuck for 2 year, 3 years.
We actually just had an incident where a client had to pay
$30,000 rate costs.
It was $30,000, $8,000 break costs.
Yep.
To get out.
I was lucky. So I had a client that it was October, November last year. She was on a 6.5% 3-year fixed rate, and she started last year. And I was like, what? What the hell have they done? And I was like, okay. And the thing is, she was luckily going on the first home guarantee scheme. I did a lot of valuations. She could refinance for under the 80%, so she can get rid of the scheme. Because generally you're stuck with that bank unless you can refinance for under 80% and remove the government as a guarantor.
Okay.
Otherwise you'll have to pay lenders mortgage insurance and you'll just basically lose your benefits.
Sure.
So this was with NAB. And yeah, so they were the higher. I don't know how they even got that rate. Like, that was horrific. Like, she, it was October last year. She got 6.5% for 3 years. I was so confused. They were never that high. The variable rates are not even that. And they never got to that. So she was always paying this higher rate. She was like, I'm just not sure. And people said that they're like paying less. And I'm like, oh, girl. Oh, man. So we, so what I did is I was like, call the bank and say you want to go to variable. Because she was at a 95% loan to value ratio with them, she was going to a 7.8% interest rate. So they would give it to her. So the thing is, when you're, when you've done, even if your value of your property has gone up in value, if you haven't done a new application with a bank, they'll still consider at the original loan to value ratio percentage. So for her, it was 95%. So that's why her rate was way higher. And then you don't have to do a new application. You just go to that. They were not going to give her a break cost fee because she was going to a higher rate. They're like, fine.
Yeah.
As soon as they did that, refinanced her. So it was straight away. Nice. So that was a way for us to avoid break costs. Because if they knew they were she was refinancing, and she was like, I want to refinance unless you get me better rate. They'll be like, oh, $8,000 break cost fee because they're making so much money off her.
Yeah.
So we refinanced her. At the time, it was like 5.8%. So it was paying 7.7% lower than what she originally was. Sure, the rates are probably around 6.1% now, but she's still paying less than what she was.
Yeah.
So that, I don't know what that broker did, but that didn't answer your question, actually. I tend to go off in tangents.
I guess I just want to say in regards to what you did with that client, that sort of that definitely goes to show that you have your client's best interests at heart, because a lot of brokers would be cautious in doing that because of their reputation with the bank, or with their BDM at the bank. Yeah. They'd be cautious about doing that. But for you to not think about that at all, not care about that at all, and be like, this is how we can get out of this bank and move on, then, you know, it goes to show, you know.
Absolutely. Or like at the moment, there are some banks that are bringing back 5.99% fixed rates. And a lot of brokers are like, this is great, because obviously it's lower than what the current variable rates are. But if you think about what the market's going to do in the next year, year and a half, probably not a good deal. They're trying to incentivize people to in there.
Yeah.
Some brokers might be like, this is a great deal. It's lower than what you're paying right now.
Yeah.
Get in for 2 years, you're going to be paying higher over the long run. So in comments or to how I realize if a broker's working in your best interests, I think it's usually a gut feeling. Mm. You will usually know. But also, do you feel comfortable enough to go to them with any question that you have? Do you feel like they're there for you through the process? Are they educating you? Are they taking the time to explain that to you? Some people don't want that. They don't care. They're like, just get it done.
Yeah.
That's generally not the kind of client that that comes to me anyway, because I have this big education platform. That's usually the clients that gravitate towards me regardless.
Yeah.
I absolutely do have people that are just like, I trust you, get it done.
Yeah.
But if you are someone that's like, are they working in my best interest? I always say, if I'm refinancing someone, I'm like, have you spoken to your broker? Because I don't want to take a commission away from a broker. I'm not here to make people lose money. I'm like, do you understand how commissions and clawbacks work?
Yeah.
A lot of people don't know how brokers get paid.
Yeah.
And that's a hard thing, because people can't quantify what we're worth because they're not paying us.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's sometimes a little bit hard as well, where people will go to like five different brokers, get them to do all the work and then choose one.
Yeah.
I don't believe in that. I believe absolutely do your first calls and figure out that part of the process, but don't make them do 40 hours of work for $0.
Do you want to explain how that clawback works?
Absolutely.
I'm sure there'll be a lot of listeners who will have no idea.
For sure. So the way a broker gets paid is through commissions. Yeah. When you're a young broker, generally you'll be working for a firm and you'll be on just salaries, but the way a broker gets paid is through commissions from the bank. Now that's split into two types of commissions, upfront and trail. So if we think about it, or if we have a computer or phone, so let's just use it really easy. It's on loan size. So if you have a $500,000 property and you've gotten a loan for $400,000, generally every bank pays the same amount of commissions. And that was a big thing with the Royal Commission, because if a bank was paying 1% commission fees and then one was paying 0.5%, well, a lot of brokers are like, well, I'm going to take you to the one I'm getting paid double.
Yeah.
So banks all pay the same. Yeah. Some of the non-conforming lenders will pay you a little bit more because there's generally a trickier deal. And also you're going to refinance them away as soon as you can. So they tend to pay you a bit more because you're going to lose some of that.
Yeah.
Scenario, you're buying a $500,000 property, 80% loan to value ratio, $400,000 loan. We'll make generally 0.65% in an upfront commission. So $2,600 at settlement. So we don't get paid until you get your keys or you do your settlement for your refinance.
Yep. Yeah.
That's when we get paid. That's around $2,600. Then we get what's called a trail commission. So every month we'll get paid what's called a trail. That's usually 0.15 or 0.1% of the loan amount. So $400,000 times that by 0.1%. It's about $400 a year. So divide that by 12, we get paid $33 a month. That slowly goes down depending on how much of a loan size you have. So as you pay that down, that trail commission goes down.
Okay.
If we refinance you within 2 years, so 24 months, most banks will give you, if you refinance within 1 year, generally it's a 100% clawback. So that $2,600 we made, we have to pay back the bank.
The
whole amount.
The upfront.
Whole
thing. Upfront.
And the trail.
The trail is usually fine. That's not touched. It's the upfront. Because the trail, it's quite negligible. It's not that much.
Sure.
So that upfront, $2,600, I'll have to pay back. So when you have like a lender's mortgage insurance refund, I basically am working for free at that point.
Yeah.
But then you get paid the upfront again with the next bank. So I'm just netting even essentially.
Sure.
But then if it's within 2 years, it's usually 50% we have to pay back. So brokers always have to have like a pool, like a little cash hub a buffer, because that can happen anytime. That's if you sell as well. If you sell a property, like we lose our commission too. So that's how we get paid. And that's why you've got to be kind of careful when a broker is like, oh, you should do a 2 or 3 year fixed rate. Because 2 years, even if it's a day after the 2 years, we'll keep our full commissions.
Yeah.
And it's really lovely. I speak to some brokers and some clients and they know, they're like, oh, well, I mean, even though my broker wasn't that great and they're not working in my best interest, like, can we wait for a day after the settlement make sure they don't
get paid? Or at least after the first year.
Yeah. And I make sure. 100%. And I'm always like, have you spoken to your broker? Have you given them a chance? I don't want to be taking anything away from anybody. But if you are completely done with them, absolutely, I'm going to help you. But educating people on how that clawback works, I'm so transparent on how much I get paid. Like we have a game plan that when we send it out to you, we've got a massive page on what we get paid. So you can see exactly by dollars what I get paid.
Yeah.
And I'm like, look at that. That's what I'm getting paid. Kind of can quantify in people's heads how much I'm worth as well.
Yeah.
But really important so people can kind of realize and quantify, because when you're not paying a professional something, sometimes you can't quantify what they're worth.
Yeah.
And therefore, if you're jumping around and those things, that happened a lot with the $4,000 cashback offers where people were like, I want to refinance every 3 to 6 months. Mm-hmm. You don't go through a broker for that, because I mean, I probably wouldn't do that either. I'm like, that's an absolutely great scenario for you to do for yourself, get, you know, $16,000 of cashback offers every year.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to help you with that. I'm just like, you should do this.
Yeah.
But you can do it on your own. I'm not going to do that for free. It's like 40 hours of work per client. You're not going to just, hand that out willy-nilly. But yeah, that's how a broker gets paid and how clawbacks work. They are starting to make them a sliding scale, which will be really good. So even if it's within the year, it might be like 75% you get back. So the longer it is, the less of the clawback there is.
Okay.
Some of them are scaling it down to 100% you keep after 18 months.
Okay.
But it makes sense for the bank. I mean, they actually end up only breaking even once you've been with the bank for 2 years. So once you think of all the fees onboarding a client and paying a broker.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people, there is that myth that if you go with a broker, you're getting a higher interest rate or a worse deal than if you went direct to the bank. We get paid essentially what they would have paid someone in the branch to do the paperwork for you.
Yeah.
They're just outsourcing. You think of us like contractors.
Yeah.
So it's just that it's less time and money for them, and they don't have to worry about the massive branches. That's why they close branches down, because we're contractors. They're paying us what they would have paid someone in the home lending team in the actual bank. So we're not if anything, we can get you a better deal because we can actually fight the banks off against each other. We have what's called pricing tools, where you see usually the big four banks, their rates online are like 8.5%, but you've got a 2.6% discount. That discount I can fight them on. And I can go, well, Westpac gave me a, 6.1% interest rate, beat it. Or I'm not bringing them here. And that's where brokers come in handy. If you go direct to a bank, well, they're going to be like, okay, this is the rate and that's it.
Yeah, exactly. Unless you want to go spend days and days and weeks and weeks and weeks going to every bank and then doing that yourself.
But then you'll find it online where there might be a 5.99% rate, but it's for a 60% loan to value ratio. It's a really specific niche.
Yeah.
Like people don't realize they're not eligible for those rates.
Yeah.
And you've got to think of your own personal scenario too. It might be an owner-occupied rate, not an investment rate, a principal and interest rate, not an interest-only rate.
Yeah.
So many variables. So that's, again, where a broker comes in.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's how we get paid. But I just do think it's really important to not take that away from any other broker.
Yeah.
But, you always want to give them the opportunity to go, hey, I really want to do this. Is there communication up to par? Every year, are they checking in and are they pricing you and making sure you're on a good interest rate compared to other banks or with your bank? Like, again, I haven't heard from that broker in 2.5 years since I settled.
Yeah.
I moved away from them within a year. And the broker I went to was like, they're going to get a callback of 100%. I'm like, I don't care. They haven't spoken to me. Like, screw them.
Yeah. Even if it was one phone call, you would have been like, okay, I'll wait a little bit.
I'll have a chat. But I have not heard a thing. Okay. Yeah. So like, that's where after settlement, you should be expecting to hear from your broker within at least 2 months after settlement and making sure that everything's going smoothly and just checking in, even if it's a 2-minute call.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then at least yearly after that to make sure they're giving you the best interest rate. You shouldn't be doing the shopping around yourself. And if you feel like you have to, just ask your broker, be like, hey, I'm looking at switching. Like, what do you recommend? Like, get them to do it. Like, that's their job.
Yeah.
So totally. You shouldn't have to feel like you need to do anything. We're the experts. We do it every day.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. As we look to wrap things up, a few more last questions. What would your biggest piece of advice be for women looking to gain financial freedom at the moment?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think that with financial freedom and women specifically, I think emotion comes into it a lot, and our future planning, I think we use that to our advantage and making sure that we're really good. We all budget. We're all quite good on that sense. I think it's about kind of what I've been saying through your whole piece of getting clarity on your priorities, your goals, and then how to get there, and having support. I think a lot of us women think that with feminism and everything, we have to do it all alone. And we think that we can do it all alone, and we absolutely can, but we lean on that support to get there. Using, I call it, especially in property or in finance, your A-team and your buyer's agents, your real estate agents, your accountants, your conveyancers, your mortgage brokers, your financial planners. We surround you and we support you to get to where you need to be. So you may feel like you don't need a partner, honestly, to do anything. The amount of single people I help is awesome. I love it. And I'm like, go get them. I was just like you, and it's awesome. It's so empowering. But make sure you have the right team around you. That's probably my biggest piece of advice. Make sure you feel comfortable with the people around you, and make sure you know that you're supported to get to where you need to be, and people hear you, see you, listen to you. If you don't feel that, they're not the right people for you, essentially.
Yeah, I 100% agree for men and women to have a really good team around them. Mortgage broker is so important. The amount of times we speak to someone who has spoken to a mortgage broker, perfect example, yourself, $500,000 pre-approval, and then spoke to a different broker, and that obviously wasn't the case. So, and then as you get more complex scenarios where there's multiple properties, a broker that understands the different lenders and the different structuring and whether to go interest in your P&I and so forth, it's so important.
You'll have a lot of brokers that won't even touch a deal under 500 grand because you're getting paid less. We get paid percentages. I do the exact same amount of work for $1 million deal for a $200,000 deal.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter anything to me, but you'll have a lot of brokers that, I mean, I go to a lot of awards nights, and that again shocked me, and I was like, oh gosh, people won't even look at people that are 20 with like a $80,000 income or something like that, or $60,000 income.
Yeah.
Like, those are the people, if we, you know, nurture them correctly, they're going to have 5 investments and they're going to be that kind of ideal client that you want right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you got to nurture them to get there. And I want to be there for that whole process. That to me is so exciting.
Yeah.
The best feeling is when you have a client that's bought their first home and you've done all the work for them, and then maybe 2 years time, they're ready to either upgrade or just refinance. And then you go back to the old notes and what they were doing for work, what their incomes were. And then you see what they're doing now.
See how it's all changed.
And you're just like, oh my God, they've gotten promotions. They're earning so much more money. They've got another investment property. It's amazing. Like, I got goosebumps even talking about it. I just think it's so special.
That's so good. Well, it's obvious how passionate you are about what you do. And I saw that you are nominated for a wellness award.
Yes, Wellness Advocate Award.
What is that?
International Women's Day. So there's about 3 major awards in mortgage broking each year. One of them's the Better Business Awards. So I'm up for Wellness Advocate of the Year. I take a little bit of a spin on it. I think that the most of them do. So a lot of it's to do with like health and fitness and doing charity runs and things like that.
Yeah.
For me, though, I look at wellness from a holistic perspective, and finance is an important part of it, just like physical, emotional, mental. There's also financial. There's those pillars of health, right? And finance really seeps into all areas of health for me.
Yeah.
So wellness advocate in terms of advocating for that financial literacy. And because, like, I mean, if you're stressed about money, you don't sleep at night. You don't eat as well. Like, it really can impact you. So that was my – that's where I kind of lent into wellness advocacy. So I do a lot of volunteer work at schools. I do a lot of these things I don't really talk about.
So good.
Do a lot of donations, like all those things. You can donate your time. You don't have to donate money. And also educating, you know, the younger generations on finances, things like that too.
Yeah.
So those kind of things all play into factor, but it was more, you know, about my Instagram and the community that I've been able to reach, and you know, it's really special to me. And the amount of people that will DM me going, you know, I've bought my first property thanks to you, and they might not be using me as a broker, and that's totally fine.
That's so good.
But it's more just like, you know, I wouldn't have been where I am if I wasn't following your journey and for the free information you've given me and the education to get that step. So it's really special.
So rewarding, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so that's the night before International Women's Day. So I'm excited.
Nice. Good luck.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm so excited. By the time this comes out, I might be an award winner.
I know that was one of your goals for the year, right?
Yeah, yeah, it'd be cool. It's just to be nominated special. So, yeah.
That's awesome. And, I mean, on that, my friend and mutual client that we were talking about before, I don't think she really would have been able to buy her second right now if she hadn't have found your page, because her previous broker was kind of not really shopping around enough, and she was in a position where she got told there's this much equity, and it was actually about $100,000 more just by you kind of going that extra mile and shopping around. So I think and then also explaining it to her in a way that made her really understand it.
Have that, like, when you look at your competition, get into that mindset of competition.
Yeah.
But then it's like if you have that mindset of collaboration, but also that there's enough
success for everyone as well.
You know, have gratitude for other people that are doing well. Absolutely. In business. And I guess it's better for your own mental health as well, along with the journey is more enjoyable.
Yeah. For sure.
So I love that collaboration over competition.
Yeah, everybody, we can learn everything off everyone. We all don't know everything. And especially like speaking to other brokers, and they're asking me, like, obviously my leverage and what I do best is probably social media and how I get my leads. Yeah. But a lot of people have been in the industry for 20 years and I'm teaching them things they don't know, but vice versa. Yeah. And, you know, I'm just trying to do things differently. And, you know, you can learn something from everybody and you can take that on and implement that into your business as well. Yeah. And that's not to steal something, but like, it's more just, again, collaborating. How can we all be better for everybody? I don't want there to be bad brokers out there and have crappy experiences like me. I want that to stop happening, whether you use me as a broker or not, or whether they use you as a buyer's agent or not.
Yeah.
We want everyone to have a good experience and for no one to be really left behind. Yeah. I just believe that everyone can be successful together.
Yeah, I love that. I guess talking about collaboration, Christy had a really good suggestion for this podcast, and you're the first guest that we're going to do this with.
Mm-hmm.
So we were going to ask you to what is one question you would ask our, or you want to ask our next guest?
Stephen Bartlett style.
Yeah. That's where I got it.
Love it.
I love that. Diary
CEO, it's my favorite. Love his potties. Usually write it down. You don't tell them. Hopefully they don't listen to it.
True, actually.
You don't tell them who the guest is, right?
No, so they write it down in a book and then...
So she'll write down the question.
And then you say it for the next person, and then they don't know who they're saying it to, and then they don't know who it's coming from.
Right, so I ruined it.
We can do it this way. I can just send the pod, but like...
Maybe we write it down then.
Yeah, if you do it Stephen Bartlett style, we write it down and then they just ask at the end of the pod.
True, because obviously they're going to hear the question, right?
Yeah.
So, okay, cool.
Maybe we can ask
You can just give me a question from someone else.
I can be the...
person that gives me a question.
Say that again.
I could ask her, we could pretend and have a question.
That, okay.
Like, this is who it's left to ask.
Do you have one?
It doesn't have to be like a property or finance question anyway.
Oh,
throw me under the bus.
Yeah.
What's the question going to be? It doesn't have to be property related.
I'm trying to think.
And then maybe
think of some
maybe,
of the ones. I'll write it.
When you write it and send it through as a text for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always try and think of the ones that's on the podcast. They have such deep ones.
Yeah, like, so deep.
Yeah, so interesting.
I'll see if Christy comes up with something, but I guess you're big on routine and structure. You said you get up quite early and you've got quite a big there's a direct correlation with those who are successful. I'm doing commas because business success is not the only success, but there's a direct correlation. Or do you think there's a direct correlation with like success and those who have really good routines and really good structures and get up at the same time every day and do the same thing in the morning and have good nighttime routines? Do you think there's a correlation and what are your routines?
I think there absolutely is a correlation. I don't think it takes away from creativity and freedom, because I think that's where all the geniuses are. They're creative minds, right?
Yeah.
And then sometimes they're quite dysfunctional, but they've just got brilliant minds. But for me, my success is really down to routine and making sure that I give myself time for freedom. I think of any routine or structure, whether it's financial or health or anything, you need to give yourself freedom and flexibility. The best kind of finance budget is something that gives you the freedom to spend and feel happy about it. So for me, my routines and structures, I get up, I go to the gym every morning, and it's whether I go to the gym and I feel crappy and I don't do much and I just go walk on the treadmill, whatever, I'm there. Usually once I'm there, I'll do it. It's getting there. It's the hard part.
Yeah.
But yeah, getting up at the same time every morning, taking 10 minutes to kind of just like wake up and not feel like I have to rush out the door.
Yeah.
I have two dogs, so cuddling with my dogs. They sleep with me when they're my babies.
What dogs are they?
They're a little Maltese cross 2 hours. So she's like a little tiny version of a Maltese, and I've got a 2 hour cross fox terrier. So they're small, so they can fit in the bed.
Cute.
Sleep. We spoon. That's great. So only people I need in my bed are my dogs. So yeah, my routines are going up, going to the gym. Then I go for a walk with the dogs in the morning, sit down, do some journaling, prep my day. I always prep my night as well, but I'll go into that. But yeah, prep my day, journal what I want to get done for the day. I plan my day out and structure it, and that's for work and everything. And then if I have anything in the evening, I'll plan that out, structure it, Instagram post or like any form of content or anything. End of the night, my routine's like shower, eat dinner, go to bed, sit down, read a book, and then journal, and then plan my day the next day.
Okay.
So kind of like that's a big thing for me. I couldn't go anywhere without my little journal that I have. And that's for me to like at the end, like a start of a work day, I take 15 minutes to prep and see if there's anything else I have to add to my list. And then I get everything done. And I do the, what's that method called? The time blocking method. There's a name for it with the guy that invented it. But I have like a little timer, 25 minutes, get everything done. I'm a competitive person, so beating a clock is always works for me. So 25 minutes of like active, like put your phone down aside. If someone calls me, like they can wait for 25 minutes.
Yeah.
Then I have 5 minutes of reset, go stretch, go do something, check on my phone, reply to messages, 25 minutes, go again.
Yeah.
And that's how I usually do my work day. And at the end of the day, I reset everything that I needed for the day and what I need to do for the next day. I'll put it all out on paper as well, because that way I can leave my work as work. My work might finish at 10 p.m., might finish at 5 p.m. Usually, I mean, you guys know, like property and finance, you don't really do a 9 to 5.
Yeah.
But as long as everything's done and it's written down, that way it doesn't take up headspace for me, and I can go and relax.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is where you don't want to burn out.
Yeah.
And that's where you need to have like work as work and home as home and keeping the things separate. And that doesn't mean that you have to work a 9 to 5. It just means you need to be able to get out of a mindset and separate it. And that way you can continue to do what you need to do and not burn out.
It's really impressive that you've learned a lot of those habits at such a young age.
Mm. Not perfect at it, but I mean, you stick to it as best as you can. Weekends sometimes get away from me, especially with social stuff, but you stick to it as much as you can. I'm kind of over that. I'm 26 now, so I'm over like the drinking phase and everything there too. So I'm trying to drink a lot less, because I find that really clouds me. Even if it's a couple, I'll lose it for the next couple of days. Like I'm just not on my game.
Yeah.
And even though I'm mentally fine, I'm not as on top of it as I probably would be.
Yeah.
So yeah, just making sure I can be in the best mindset I can be for my clients and making sure I use that moving forward. Yeah.
Nice.
So I guess that's a long-winded answer of what my routine is.
That was a great answer. Thank you.
Yeah. Writing things down is a big thing. Getting it all out.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'd love for you to write down a question for the next
guest. Absolutely, we'll
do. Make sure when you're in Sydney next, we'd love to meet you again. Maybe go down to Warfar, have some lunch.
Absolutely.
We just said we don't drink, but maybe have a
bottomless brunch.
Thank you so much, Maddie.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Maddie.
Thanks.